All right. Deuteronomy 19. And again, this is dropping down in the middle of the Lord's direction to his people just before they come into the promised land. Some of this is a restatement of things that he has said in other places. Some of it's a little more clarification on a couple items. We'll see what kind of ground we can cover tonight. Deuteronomy 19, verse 1. When the Lord thy God has cut off the nations whose land the Lord thy God has given thee, and thou succeedest them, and dwellest in their cities and in their houses, thou shalt prepare, separate three cities for thee in the midst of thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it. Thou shalt prepare thee a way, and divide the coast of thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee to inherit, into three parts, that every slayer may flee thither. And this is going into a section on the cities of refuge. They're first mentioned back in Exodus 21. In several other places, Numbers 35 talks about it. And the idea is, as we get into this, that if you accidentally killed somebody, manslaughter, not murder, but accidentally, there would be these cities of refuge that you could flee to. And they disperse them throughout the land. There's three that he talks about here, and he makes provision for three more later on, so they won't be too far away. That if you accidentally kill someone, you can go to and get refuge and be in that city. And if you remember from Numbers 35 when we went through that talking about those cities, the idea is, well, part of the prescription was you go there, you go before the elders of the city, you plead your case, because there is what's called the avenger of blood. In fact, let's read down to verse 6. It says this, and this is the case of the slayer which shall flee thither, that he may live. Whoso killeth his neighbor ignorantly, whom he hated not in time past, and he gives an example, as when a man goes into the wood with his neighbor to hew wood, and his hand stretcheth a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slippeth from the helve and lighteth upon his neighbor that he die, he shall flee into one of those cities and live, lest the avenger of blood pursue the slayer while his heart is hot and overtake him, because the way is long, and slay him, whereas he was not worthy of death, inasmuch as he hated him not in time past. And so what would happen is, if you killed somebody accidentally, and he gives the example of someone out cutting wood and the axe head flies off on a backstroke and strikes his buddy dead, they mention the avenger of blood. If you were the next of kin, one of the responsibilities that you got was to be the avenger of blood. And if somebody killed my brother, it was my responsibility to go find the guy who did it and kill him, make him pay. I was the one who executed justice. And so the avenger of blood, and that was justified. In fact, it was a responsibility. It was part of the same as the responsibility for redeeming the land. We talk about the kinsman redeemer, which is a type of Christ, is the one who bought us back from slavery. And there's provision in the law for that, for someone who's, because the land was attached to the family, if the husband dies and doesn't raise up seed, then the kinsman redeemer, like the book of Ruth, can take the woman to wife and have a child through her and keep the land and the family. And that's a type of Christ, in that he redeems us. He's a kinsman. He came as a man, yet he could buy us because he was without sin. Well, the other side is the avenger of blood. And when you look at Christ and you realize he's coming back for his bride, which is us, and then he's coming back with his bride to judge a Christ-rejecting world, he's also filling that role of avenger of blood. And so the avenger of blood would be the one who'd go out and exact justice, find the one who killed his relative and take care of business. And what he's saying is, if that happens accidentally, he's not guilty of murder. It was manslaughter. It was accidental. And so he could flee to this city, a city of refuge. And if he gets there before the guy catches him and kills him, and presumably when it happens, you drop the axe and you start running because you want to beat him there. If you can get to that city before he catches up with you and go to the elders and explain your case, he'll be safe as long as he stays there. He can't leave. If he leaves, the avenger of blood can be waiting outside the city and kill him dead. He's got to stay inside the city, and he's allowed to stay in there until the death of the high priest. Once the high priest, whoever it was at the time, finally dies, when they consecrate another high priest, then it's all canceled, and he can go back to his family and to his homeland. And of course, that is a type of Christ in that. He's our city of refuge. We flee to him, and being our high priest, he's died, so now we're free. Well, this is just some of the prescription that was given before, talking about making that provision. And, you know, it's interesting when you read about the avenger of blood. Understand that's still part of that culture. Maybe so, not so much the Jewish culture, but it is a lot of the other Arab nations in that land. And you see you know, we turn on the TV and we see all the fighting on there, and we see the jihad, and we see, I mean, how many times have you seen news clips where they're carrying some bloody body down a street, and there's hundreds of people out there all yelling and people going nuts? Well, in their culture, in their mind, it is their duty to go out and find the person who killed their relative and kill him. And what happens is, somebody does something over here, they pick a fight, they kill somebody with a bomb blast, well, then his relatives strap on a bomb and go kill a bunch of people over here. Well, then they go and strap on, you know, and pretty soon you've got everybody just riled up. And it's part of the culture. It all comes back to this, the avenger of blood. And so here's a provision made for manslaughter. And it's, you know, he's going to go on and talk about that a little bit more. Because the Lord draws a very clear distinction between murder and between manslaughter. Motive comes into it. And it is right for us as a legal system to determine motive when we look at murder, when we look at crimes. Now, he says in verse 7, "Wherefore I command thee, saying, Thou shalt separate three cities for thee. And if the Lord thy God enlarge thy coast, as he has sworn unto thy fathers, to give thee all the land which he promised to give unto thy fathers, if thou shalt keep all these commandments to do them, which I command thee this day, to love the Lord thy God, and to walk ever in his ways, then shalt thou add three cities more for thee beside these three." And notice the if then there. The idea is, you know, the provision is for six, because the land is going to be big enough that you're going to need six of these cities to make them equal distance. I think somebody was never supposed to be more than a half day's journey from one of these cities, if possible. The problem is, it was dependent upon whether or not they actually did what the Lord said. Because if they trusted him, they kept his commandments, they actually took the land he provided, which they never really did. They never made it. I mean, they're supposed to go all the way from the great river Euphrates to, I forget, the other end of their border. They never received that. In fact, they're even now, what are they? They pulled out of Gaza. They've pulled out of, I can't think of the name. But I mean, here they have pulled back from land that they were supposed to have. And of course, it hasn't done them a whole lot of good. It's just given their enemies closer positions to set up rockets. But it was dependent. If they actually obeyed the Lord, they trusted and they stepped out, they took the land that he's given, then he would enlarge their borders enough that they'd need six of these cities. That, in verse 10, innocent blood be not shed in thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance, and so blood be upon thee. And interesting, he is holding the whole people responsible for innocent blood being shed in the land. And he does this, he's going to hold the rulers responsible, he's going to hold the people responsible, because he is a God of justice. You know, we certainly look for mercy and we look for grace, but we have to understand he's also a just God. He's a just judge, and he is about justice. And it offends the Lord when there is injustice in the land. And he doesn't want innocent blood to be shed. He says, but, in verse 11, if any man hate his neighbor, and lie in wait for him, and rise up against him, and smite him mortally that he die, and fleeth into one of these cities, then the elders of the city shall send and fetch him thence, and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood, that he may die. Thine eye shall not pity him, but thou shalt put away the guilt of innocent blood from Israel, that it may go well with thee. If somebody who actually murders somebody then flees to a city of refuge and says, no, it was an accident, and they determine that, no, it wasn't, it was murder, they can't hide him. They're not to pity him, no matter how much he pleads about the fact that he was brought up in an abusive home and his parents didn't show him the love he needed and he wasn't given everything he should have had and he's got, you know, attention hyper deficiency active disorder syndrome, whatever it is, that doesn't really matter whether it's if you did it, then you pay. And, you know, the Lord requires that of leadership. And, you know, some people get confused about this. Romans chapter 13, verse 1 says this: let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there's no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation, meaning judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Individually, we are to be merciful, we're to be forgiving. Societally, we're to be just, and we're to be fair, and punishment is to be swift. And it's funny how screwed up Christians can get about that. You know, there is one whole side of Christianity that says, how can you possibly be for the death penalty and yet be against abortion? It doesn't make any sense. We shouldn't be killing people who kill people to show people that kill people, killing is bad. Or I forget how that goes. It's stupid. And, you know, you look at some of the countries in this world, they deal with crime very differently than we do. Singapore is an interesting example because in Singapore, they're very harsh. The rules are laid out there, and when you commit the crime, boom, punishment is quick and it's bad, always. You remember that guy, I can't remember his name, however many years back, that was an American over there, young guy, got caught, I think, spray painting? Is that what he did? Graffiti. And so he was sentenced to, I don't remember how many lashes with a cane, which is this long bamboo rod that is extremely painful. They actually bare your bottom, which I really like, just a bare bottom spanking, and they lay out and they hit you with this pole and however many lashes, and it usually you pass out from the pain partway through. It's that bad. Doesn't kill you, but it hurts tremendously to the point where you pass out, and then they wake you up to get the rest of your lashes so that you get the whole effect. But even beyond that, drugs is a capital offense in Singapore. If you get caught trafficking in drugs, the police, I believe, have the right to pull you out of the car and shoot you on the spot. They don't mess around. If you come to Singapore, you do drugs, your life is forfeit. You just know that right off the bat. As a result, crime rate in Singapore is really low. It's funny, I was looking at some sites. Of course, I looked at Amnesty International. I don't know if you've ever looked at any of Amnesty International. But it's horrible. Horrible. They put people to death in Singapore. Do you have any idea? Do you know since 1991 they've executed about 400 people in Singapore? Well, I just was looking at some murder rates, okay? Singapore, the murder rate is 4.3 people per million. That means for every million people in Singapore, 4.3 every year get murdered. In Maine, it's 1.2 per 100,000, which makes us at about 12 per million. In Maine, that's the murder rate. It's not that bad when you look at it. Washington, D.C., on the other hand, which is our nation's capital, they only have 600,000 people. Last year, out of those 600,000 people, 262 were murdered, which would make their murder rate 45.8 per 100,000 or 450-something per million, which is roughly 100 times worse than Singapore. But nobody gets put to death in Washington, D.C. And, you know, they had quotes on the Amnesty International site of people saying, I don't know of any case where the executions that I did, you know, caused any, you know, kept any more murders from happening. It certainly kept them from murdering anymore. No doubt about it. There was no repeat offenders in Singapore. And I'm not saying that I want to go there because, you know, you go to a lot of Arab nations, you steal, you lose a hand, you know, and you see people walking around with one hand missing and you know, especially we talked about before they cut off the right hand. And the right hand's for fellowship, and the left hand is for doing business. And if they cut off your right hand, you got one for both, and so nobody wants to eat with you anymore. Nobody wants to help shake your hand. You're an ostracized. On one hand, you know, that's pretty harsh. On the other hand, you can walk the streets in Singapore and not worry at all. You don't have to worry about anybody, you know, getting into your car. You don't have to worry, for the most part, about your kids being brought up on drugs. Because they kill anybody who tries to do it. And so, you know, I can see some benefits there. The Lord is like, I'm all about swift and fair, you know, punishment. And I don't... The thing is, some people think he's slack. You know, you get into Peter where it talks about those people saying, you know, where's the promise of his coming? He doesn't care. He's not concerned about the affairs of people. And they mistake his patience and his mercy for his apathy and his non-concern of what's going on. And the truth is, we all want justice for the other guy. We all want mercy for ourselves. If he came back right now, anybody who doesn't know him is going to be left out, and they're going to be condemned to hell forever. And, you know, I can pray right now, Lord, please come quickly. Come back today, because I'm ready to go. But there were people praying that back in the 70s, when my mother first got saved. And if he'd listened to them, I'd be rotten in hell. So I'm really glad that he didn't listen then. Now it's a different story. But, you know, the truth is the Lord is very merciful. But when he does come, it's not that it's going to be, I mean, they've been thinking he's coming back for 2,000 years. And he is coming back. And every day it seems like it's that much closer, especially looking at what's going on in the world. But when he does come back, it'll be quick when he does what he does. Because there is justice, and he is a just God. And so when his patience is up, it's time to take care of business. And the rulers, even though they don't know the Lord, the police are still, you know, you see Matt or you see, of course, Matt or Nelson or some of them that are Christians going by. It's a lot easier to submit to them because they're brothers in the Lord. But even the ones that don't know the Lord, they're still, in some ways, ministers of God. And we need to respect them because they are, in a way, working for God by being just and making sure that society is maintained. He's a God of order. He's not a God of chaos. And so they're not to take a sob story. They are to put away the guilt of innocent blood from Israel, that it may go well with us. Verse 14, thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance, which thou shalt inherit in the land that the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it. Pretty simple command, one verse, but yet he has to put it in there because he knows us. And, you know, the land is inherited from father to son down through the generations. And we live, you know, for us, the ancient landmark is a metal stake with a piece of orange ribbon tied. That's the landmark. That's the border. I have those around the outside of my house where my property lines are. And what they're saying is, don't go out in the middle of the night and slide that pole over a few feet to expand your borders, because that's you know, it's stealing from your brother. I know when I first moved into my house, my property line runs right next to my driveway. My neighbors are right there. I had a new shed brought in, and the guy who brought it, they brought it in on skids and laid it down, and next door neighbor happened to notice that my shed was about a foot onto their property. So I got to pay somebody to come back and put it back. You know, I would like to have gone at night and moved the ancient landmark, but really, that's the right thing to do now. It's his property. And Lord's just saying, look, don't steal from your brother by taking his land. Unfortunate, but he has to say it because that's the type of people we are. He says, one witness in verse 15 shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin or in any sin that he sinneth. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall a matter be established. Because, again, he's concerned about fairness and justice, but he doesn't want anybody to unfairly be condemned because we all know people lie. And he doesn't want one person to bring up a bad report and cause something to happen to someone when it's not corroborated. In fact, he talks about false witnesses. He says in verse 16, if a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges, notice who gets involved, which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition. And behold, if the witnesses be a false witness, and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall you do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put away evil from among you. And those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. And thine eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Interesting. Apparently, punishment, according to the Lord in verse 20, is actually a deterrent, because those which remain shall hear and fear and shall henceforth commit no more any more such evil. I mean, it's pretty simple, biblical. And again, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, hand for a hand, foot for a foot, in the context of society bringing justice. Individually, as Christians, Jesus tells us to turn the other cheek. He tells us to forgive. In light of what we've been forgiven, we need to forgive much, but there is a difference. Chapter 20. When thou goest out to battle against thine enemies. Now again, they're about to enter into the battle. And in many ways, coming into, a lot of people talk about crossing Jordan, coming into the promised land like going to heaven. No, because they cross Jordan and they go into the promised land, the first thing they do is they fight. There's giants in the land, there's battles to be done, there's a lot of work. This is Christian living, is what a picture of going into the land is. And he says, when you go out to battle against thine enemies, and seest horses and chariots and a people more than thou, be not afraid of them, for the Lord thy God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And that is like the Lord, first of all, to let you know, by the way, there's going to be more of them than there is of you. You know, we know that's just the way it is. There's always going to be more against you than there are for you, because narrow is the way and few there be that find it. And when you go, don't be afraid of him, because God's with you. He brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And here he is reminding them, you can trust me, because remember what I did before. Remember how I delivered you when there was more of them and you were trapped between an army and the Red Sea. And remember the plagues I brought. going back to the miraculous things he'd done in their life. And we need to be brought there too. You know, I don't know about you, but I frequently need to be reminded of the things that he's done, because if I just look ahead at all the stuff in front of me that seems insurmountable, it can get pretty depressing. But when you look back and you see where you've come and you see the ways that he's delivered you, it gives you a little bit of hope. This is pretty interesting. He says, "It shall be when you come nigh unto battle that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people." Getting ready to go out to fight, they don't call for a general, they call for the priest. "And he shall say unto them," which flies in the face of this section of what most people would think, "Hear, O Israel, you approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint. Fear not, and do not tremble, neither be ye terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." And the officers, so the priest comes out and encourages the people. And that is the job, of course. You know, the New Testament talks of us in some ways of being priests. And that's our role with one another. You know, we come together, smaller group on Thursday night. I was down in Bangor last night. I went to Calvary Orrington. And it was a good time. And getting together with people afterwards to fellowship, to pray for one another, and encourage one another. You know, of course, I go there and everybody's like, "What's going on in Lincoln? Tell me about Lincoln. It's so great in Lincoln," you know. And it is great in Lincoln. But you know, I live in Lincoln. And so all the stuff that happens in my life goes on in Lincoln too. And, you know, everybody struggles. But yet, it's good for me to go there and encourage people with what the Lord's doing up here and what I see in your lives. And it's good for me to go down there and see people growing and new faces down there. And that's part of what the point is of getting together, is to build one another up and remind us, just like the priest did there, "The Lord your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." Then in verse 5 it says, "And the officers shall speak unto the people, saying, What man is there that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it." So here you are, getting ready to go to battle. Everybody's in the front line. The officers step up. "All right, any of you guys just build a house? You, go home. We don't need you. That's all right. You just go home because, I mean, you know, perchance you'll die and you'll never get the chance. You've been working on this house. You know, you've saved everything you could. You've got this house ready to move in, and then you get drafted to go to war. Just go home. Don't worry about it. We'll do without you." And then he says this. Verse 6, "And what man is he that has planted a vineyard and has not yet eaten of it? Let him also go and return unto his house, lest he die in battle and another man eat of it." Oh, you, your garden's coming in. You planted all those cucumbers. Now your wife's drowning in them. Just go home. Just eat your cukes. Don't worry about it. We'll do without you. So they're thinning out the army here. I mean, normally you get ready for battle and you bring everybody who's got a pulse into fight. Nope, not Israel. In fact, how about this, verse 7? "What man is there that has betrothed a wife and has not yet taken her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her." You know what? You guys, you just engaged. You haven't really, you know, had your honeymoon. Just go home. We don't need you. We'll fight without you, no problem. You know, so you see people melting off the lines. Then they get to verse 8. "And the officers shall speak further unto the people. And they shall say, What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well at his heart." So after they get rid of everybody who's got a somewhat legitimate excuse, they say, "Any of you guys scared? You know, okay, go home. We don't need you." I mean, imagine what you're left with people. You got some brave ones left or some stupid ones, but I mean, the rest, just gone. I mean, if they went now, I mean, we live in a society that has a volunteer army right now. And, you know, people are there because they signed up. However, I think if you went, you'd find a lot of the people in there right now signed up to get a college degree, get their school paid for, see the world, maybe get a tattoo somewhere in East Asia, you know, and then come home. And now they're in a desert and they're getting shot at and bombs are going off. If someone was to come along and say, "Hey, what do you think? Anybody scared? Just go. We're all set without you." But look why. It's because of what he said in verse 4. "The Lord your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." Now, if you're a military commander and you read this scripture, you got to be thinking, "Are you insane? You just got rid of most of my force. I got nobody to fight with." But if you're going out led of the Lord and the Lord is leading your men into battle, it doesn't matter. Because, you know, he can do it with a lot or with a little. Is interesting. I'm going through my own personal reading. I'm in 2 Samuel. And I read chapter 10 today, and there's a section in there where the Israelites go out to battle, and Joab is leading the army, and he's got his brother Abishai with him, and they face an army that's bigger than them, and they're surrounded. And so Joab says, all right, I'll take half and I'll go this way and fight on this side. You take Abishai the other half and you fight those that are on that side. And if they start to overwhelm me, you come help me. And if they start to overwhelm you, I'll come help you. And then he says this in verse 12. He says, be of good courage and let us play the men for our people and for the cities of our God. And the Lord do that which seemeth good to him. And he's saying, you know what? And again, you got to figure, Pastor Ken taught in this in the men's conference last year, and it had an effect on me. And he's saying, here's two brothers, and now they're going out to battle, and they're facing a whole lot more people than they have. And they said, you know what? If you start going down, I'll fight for you. And if I start going down, you fight for me. And let's just be of good courage, and let's play the men. Almost like, let's act like the men that we used to play like when we were kids. You remember when we were kids, we'd play soldiers, and I'd be G.I. Joe, and you'd be Rambo, or let's play the men. Let's be the soldiers we always dreamed we would be. And let's do it for our people and for the cities that God has given us. And we'll let the Lord do what seems good to him. And he'll fight for us. In fact, 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 6, Jonathan and his armor bearer, they're getting ready to fight the Philistines. Saul's son, he just kind of wakes up at night. And he says this to his armor bearer. Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over under the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there's no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And he's saying, tell you what, let's you and I go take on the army. Because, if God's going to do it, what does it matter if he's got a couple hundred or a couple thousand? Let's see what he'll do for two people. And Jonathan's brave. How about the armor bearer? This is his answer. And his armor bearer said unto him, do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. Here's the armor bearer actually saying, you know what, Jonathan, you want to go, I'll go with you. If the Lord is calling you to step out and to fight an insurmountable battle, I got your back. And the two of them go out and uses them to destroy a whole group of Philistines. The Philistines freak out and they start fighting against each other. And the two of them just have this great victory, because they realize that God was fighting for them. And that's what they're saying here. Well, I don't care. Send them all home. Gideon, we see the same thing. You got too many guys. If you win with that many guys, you're going to think you did it. So just send them all home. He gets down to 300 guys so that they would finally realize that the Lord is the one who's fighting. I do find it interesting that in verse 8, he kicks out all of the fearful and faint-hearted and lets him go home, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16 talks about some stuff that God hates, which is worth taking note of. And it says, these six things does the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among the brethren. And in that list is somebody who causes instability, who tears down the faith of others by sowing discord. And here the Lord knows that somebody who's scared to be in the battle is not only going to be useless, they're going to be taking out other people on their team. And it's better not to have them in there at all than it is to have them there scared and causing other people to lose heart. Those people who went home to a wife, who went home to a vineyard, who went home to their house they just built, those people who went home because they were scared, they were safe. They didn't die. But they didn't get to see the walls go down in Jericho. They didn't get to see the Lord work in an amazing way. They didn't get to see a whole army wiped out before two guys because they trusted the Lord. And there might be some safety when you turn away from the battle, but it's only in the middle of the battle that you actually see the Lord working. And it's the same way in the Christian life. You look at the average Christian and then compare them to, say, the average missionary. Whose faith do you think burns hotter? Who trusts the Lord more? The person who's out there and facing an overwhelming army of unsaved people, or the person who is facing their 401k and their, it's just not the same. And the Lord, I was encouraged. I read that thing in 2 Samuel today, and be of good courage, play the men, see what the Lord will do. It says in verse 10, and when thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make the answer of peace and open unto thee, then it shall be that thy people, all the people that is found therein, shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God has delivered it into thine hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. But the women and the little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, even the spoil thereof, shalt thou take unto thyself, and thou shalt eat of the spoil of thine enemies, which the Lord thy God has given thee. Thus shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not in the cities of these nations. And this prescription is for not the land that they were given, and he's going to show them what they should do for them, but the ones that are outside of that. If they go outside of the boundaries of the land he's promised, and they come to other cities, they go up to the city, they're not to just indiscriminately, you know, he gave them a section of land, work within that section. If you end up fighting outside and you go to a city, offer it peace. If it accepts a peace, good. It'll be tributaries. They'll pay taxes to you, and you don't have to fight. But if they resist you, kill all the men. Kill them all. Don't leave any of them. You can keep the women, you can keep the children, you can keep the goods that are in the city. But if they accept peace, give them peace. However, it says in verse 16, but of the cities of these people which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance in the land, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord thy God has commanded thee, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations which they have done unto their gods, so should you sin against the Lord your God. Now, for those groups that are in the land, he says, I want them gone. I want them completely gone. I don't care whether they want peace or not. You will wipe them out completely, man, woman, child. And you might say, boys, that's awful harsh. I mean, here is God telling them to do it. And it's funny. It's something that you hear frequently. You know, I mentioned before that I've been having an ongoing conversation with a member of the clergy. And in that, one of the things, because we've talked about the Bible and the reliability of the word and whether or not to take it literally. And I say, yeah, I do take it literally. Why shouldn't I take it literally? And their response has been, well, if you take the Bible literally, then you must be okay with genocide, and you must be okay with capital punishment if you steal a sheep, and you must be okay with, and it lists a bunch of things. Actually, they were like, well, you must be okay with, you know, the hatred of women, and you must be okay with slavery, and you must be okay with all it. And you have to understand, you know, and my answer to that is, well, some of it, yeah, genocide, I'm okay with. I really am, because God made these people, and he told the Israelites flat out, I'm using you to judge them because of what they've done. In fact, when they went down into Egypt, Abraham was told, you're going to be in there for 400 years because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. They're bad, and these people were horribly bad. They had perversion mastered to an art form where they were sacrificing their children and adults, they were sacrificing the lives to their gods. They were horribly sexual perverse. They were bad in every way possible. And the Lord had said, that's enough. I've given them enough time. I'm wiping them out. I made them. I can take them out. Same thing our parents have told us. I made you. I can take you out. Well, God actually did make them, and he can take them out. And he's decided to use Israel. And he says, don't think it's because you're so great. It's just they're so bad, and I'm using you because you're foolish. And if the Lord decides to judge them, that's righteous. And so, yeah, it's okay. It's judgment. It there's nothing wrong with that. Otherwise, he would be unjust. If he didn't care, you know, and some look at that and they say, well, that's not loving. That's not Christian. Look, the Lord looks at that like kidnapping, okay? Because he said, if you leave them around, what's going to happen is you're going to bring them in, and you're going to go after doing the same things they do, and you're going to be turned from me, and you're going to go astray. And they'll be basically kidnapping your children and leading them after their false gods. Now, I can claim to be a Christian. I can claim to love the Lord. And, yeah, I also know that I'm called to turn the other cheek. And you know, you have to weigh that out. But if somebody breaks in my house to take one of my kids, I can't with a straight face say, I love my kids, but I'm a Christian, so you just take them and have your way. Bull crap. Excuse my language. You know, my kids, I don't think so. You come into my house and you'll find out why I live in a state that allows us to keep and bear arms. If you come after my kids, that's the way it is. Because I can't say that I love them and allow them to be plundered. I saw some news. I mean, one of the reasons I looked at the news today, and that's why I'm like, Lord, please come quickly. And there was some news story on there about some 8-year-old girl in Florida getting raped outside, broad daylight outside of a park, that people saw it. And nobody did anything. Imagine that. Nobody did anything. You know what? Who loved that little girl? Nobody who saw it did. I don't care what you say. No, they didn't. And so God loves his kids. And he's like, I'm not letting you get ripped off. I've given them their chance. They've had their chance. You get in there, you kill them all. I don't want them around to lead you astray because they are beyond the point of redemption. Does God know? Yes. Has he seen their hearts? Yes. Is he just and merciful? And is he merciful and forgiving? Yes. He gave them another 400 years, but it didn't get any better. And they got to the point where there was no turning back. That, you know, there are other things that happen in the Bible, and just because it happened in the Bible and it's recorded in the Bible doesn't mean it's right. You know, you see David, he had a bunch of wives. He had concubines. Solomon had hundreds of wives, hundreds of concubines. Is that God's plan? No, his plan was one man, one woman for life. But yet he also knows that they're sinful creatures, and so it records the fact that they had more wives. He says in a couple, was it last week or the week before, when you have a king, he shouldn't multiply wives unto himself. Don't do it. But yet they did it anyway. It doesn't mean it was supported by God. Slavery, most of the slavery you see in the Bible is slavery because of debt, not because of race. You know, we think slavery and we think of, you know, the African slaves that came to the United States when we stole them from their homeland to have them work for us. That wasn't what happened in Israel. If you had a debt you couldn't pay, you were responsible for the debt. There was no bankruptcy. Your bankruptcy was going and being sold into slavery to pay off your debt. Could last 7 years. That was it. It was financial slavery. And we're in financial slavery now. It's just to the bank. It's not to another person. You know, hatred of women. Were women abused in the Bible? Some. Was that God's plan? No. Am I called to hate my wife? No. I'm called to love my wife and to go, you know, as Christ loved the church. He went into our world and died. I'm supposed to go into our world and die. You know, just because the Bible is literal on some points, you have to understand where it's coming from and how God looks at what these people would do to his children if he allowed them to stay around. And that's why he said wipe them out. It wasn't because he's mean, it's because he's just and he loves his kids. Verse 19, when thou shalt besiege a city a long time, and this is interesting to me too, these last two verses, look at this. When thou shalt besiege a city a long time in making war against it to take it, thou shalt not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them, for thou mayest eat of them, and thou shalt not cut them down, for the tree of the field is man's life to employ them in the siege. Only the trees which thou knowest that they be not trees for meat, thou shalt destroy and cut them down, and thou shalt build bulwarks against the city and make war with thee until it be subdued. Little common sense. Look, guys, you're going in. You're going to take this land. You're taking it to live there. That's the point. Don't strip it on the way through so that you have nothing. These fruit trees, you got to cut down, make a battering ram. Look for an oak. Leave the fruit trees alone. You're going to want to eat from that. That's part of the provision. I've given you a land with fruit trees. Don't cut them all down to burn out your enemies. Just use, you know, it's just a little common sense there. But again, God caring about his children enough to give them some instruction. All right. Chapter 21. We're going to make time. Deuteronomy's a long book. If one be found slain in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it, lying in the field, and it be not known who has slain him, then the elders and thy judges shall come forth, and they shall measure unto the cities which are round about him that is slain. And it shall be that the city which is next unto the slain man, even the elders of that city, shall take a heifer, which has not been wrought with, and which has not drawn in the yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring down the heifer unto a rough valley, which is neither eared nor sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley. And the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for them the Lord thy God has chosen to minister unto him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And by their word shall every controversy and every stroke be tried. And all the elders of that city that are next to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. Be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge, and the blood shall be forgiven them. So shalt thou put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you, when thou shalt do that which is right in the sight of the Lord. And he's saying, okay, somebody's found dead out in the field, outside of a city. You don't know who did it. There's nobody apparently guilty. I want you to find which is the closest city. I want you to pull the elders out. I want you to get a heifer, take it to a valley. And he gives this provision. This isn't a Levitical sacrifice. This is, again, a piece of the idea that the Lord is about justice. And he's also not into the perversion of justice. And in a way, what this is doing, they'd have to get this heifer and they'd go down. It says strike off the neck. It's not exactly sure whether it's break the neck or cut off the head. It seems to imply a couple verses later in verse 6 that it's beheaded, but there's some controversy on that, I guess. Either way, the calf doesn't care. It's the same for him whether his neck's broke or his head's cut off. But it's taking the people who are in authority, who are responsible to the Lord, the judges, and they do it, and the elders, and they do it in front of the priests, to task for the fact that somebody was killed close to their city, which they're responsible for. And it's almost like a tangible reminder of the fact that God requires the blood of an innocent at the hands of those who are in charge. And here is a procedure that they go through. It's not like it makes a sacrifice to atone for something happening. I think more than anything, it's a procedure that's done to remind those in authority that it's not given lightly, and that the Lord puts you in a place of authority, and he expects you to be just, and he's going to hold you accountable. And certainly, if they're having their hands involved in the killing of this thing, I mean, we've talked about, as we went through the Levitical system, when a person came to bring a sacrifice to the altar, as the priest did the job of cutting its throat, they'd have their hands on it so that it would be a physical reminder that the wages of sin is death, and that without the shedding of blood, there's no remission for sins, and that because of the things you did, somebody had to die. And, you know, if you've ever been involved in the slaughtering of an animal, or I know I was involved in the cutting off of tails and the castrating of little sheep, made an impression on me as a little child. It's never gone away, of having to be there, you know, that poor little lamb. But there's anything like that, it really leaves a mark on you. And I think the purpose of this is to show those people who are in charge. You know, everybody wants to be in charge. Everybody wants to be elected to office. You know, people love to be on boards, and people love to be in office, to be mayor and to be governor and to be on town council and school board and this and that, to make decisions. But it's important to remember that the authority is a charge from the Lord, and there's a responsibility that goes with that. And the Lord wants to make sure that the poor and the downtrodden, that their causes are taken up. We're going through the section on Saturday. We'll be in the section in Luke that talks about the unjust judge and you know, the woman who comes to him day and night. The Lord uses that for an example. But he, all throughout the scripture, he cares about, especially the widows, the orphans, and the stranger. Those are people that the Lord's heart goes out to. And you look at this, it's not as a sacrifice, but it's just a reminder. Authority is a charge from the Lord. And, you know, all of us have authority to some degree. We're responsible for the way that we present the gospel to people. We're responsible for the way that we present Christ to people. We're responsible for the words that we drop and for the actions that we do. You know, and we have a merciful God. I mean, we're saved, we're cleansed, we're forgiven. But I want to hear, "Well done, a good and faithful servant," when I see the Lord. I don't want to be ashamed for the way that I've misused the trust that's been placed over me. And I look at that, and it speaks to me about, you know, remembering the ministry I've been given and remember whose sheep it is. That's probably a pretty good place to stop. Let's pray, and then look, we're here midweek. If you need prayer, come see me. Come see one of the guys, one of the ladies, because this is a place to get prayer, to hold one another up, to remind each other that the Lord is fighting the battle and that he's in control. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that you are a good God. You're not willing any should perish. Lord, I pray if there's anybody here, Lord, that doesn't know you, that they would not leave that way, and they would know, Lord, that you love your children so much. Not only are you concerned about justice, Lord, but you're concerned about forgiveness, enough that you would send your son to die in their place. That's how much you care about him. And Lord, please let that message be on our lips, Lord, and let that be in our lives, that other people would see that we've been forgiven and therefore that we would forgive much. Lord, please let us be merciful and graceful and forgiving. And Lord, please give us an answer for them that would ask of the hope that we have. Please bless my brothers and sisters. Encourage them, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.